Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode. What this episode is going to cover is something that's actually really unique and special to what I've seen in the detection dog world. And I'm here still in Australia, and in this episode, we're going to talk to handlers and trainers who work water leak and wastewater detection dogs here in Sydney. So with that said, I'd like to welcome, and I'm going to butcher their names, but Bettina, yes, yep.
Bettina.
And then Nicole, and then Kylie. Yep. Yeah. Did I say, I know you do Kylie Lee, right? Yeah, so close enough, yeah. But thank you guys for coming on to the show and helping us understand, actually, this very unique skill that's out there, because I think the average person, when you say the dogs detect water, are going to be, how does a dog detect something that's odorless, colorless, and things like that? And we kind of know it's actually not necessarily odorless, but for us, it's different. So with that, I will start off. I'll kind of let you guys do an introduction of each of one of you guys and tell us about you, your dog's name, and then me and Glenn will start firing away with questions, but I'll start right here since we're right here with Bettina.
My name's Bettina Grieve, and I'm a wastewater leak detection dog handler. I have two dogs, Winnie and Ziggy, who I work with Kylie. And wastewater is anything that goes out of the house.
Okay.
It's probably the best summary for it.
That summarizes a lot of things, doesn't it?
It does. It includes a lot of things. Very
basically
glamorous.
Basically, not the clean water, correct? It's this whatever's dirty that comes out or that's not been filtered or things like that, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So my background was as an aquatic ecologist, but I've always loved dogs, and a unique opportunity came up at Sydney Water.
Okay. On to the next.
My name's Nicole Harvey, and I am the water leak detection dog handler and trainer. We have two dogs currently, Joey, and we have Hydro. So Hydro was our first dog we trained internally at Sydney Water, which was really excited. And he's just hit the ground running. He's 18 months old, so he's in the field now working, which is really exciting. My background's a little bit different to Bettina's. Okay. I actually came from biosecurity, so I have a degree in agriculture science. And I worked with biosecurity for 20 years before I came to Sydney Water. I was a detection dog handler at the airport there. And then I started working with another trainer, Steve Austin, outside of work, doing some volunteer work with him and doing some courses. And we came across Sydney Water doing some work with that, which was really exciting. And I found it so fascinating that this was such a new industry that was developing, and dogs had never been considered before. So as soon as I found out there was an opportunity to follow Joey at the time, he was a young pup, follow him through his process, I took up the opportunity to jump on to Sydney Water and become the water leak detection dog handler.
How long have you been doing? So two things, how long have you been working a dog, and then how long have you been in the water leak detection?
So before I came to Sydney Water, I was with biosecurity for 6 years as a detection dog handler. Mm-hmm. And then I now have been working Joey for just over 2.5 years with Sydney Water.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a pretty good diverse background, but you had some dog handling experience before you began.
I did. And I was always interested in dog handling. Like, I volunteered at a lot of rescue places beforehand. I wanted to look at things that I could do with my kids, and I brought my kids in to volunteer at a few different kennels. And that's where I really developed that fascinating interest with dog behavior. Yeah. And then I looked at scent detection. And then when the opportunity came up with biosecurity to join that dog unit, I was at that stage in my life where my kids were a little bit older, and I was able to jump on it and start my career with dog handling. So that was very exciting to me.
Perfect. All right. On to the next.
Yeah. Hi, Glenn. Hi, Cameron. Thanks for having us today. Really excited to be here and talk more dog work. My name's Kylie. I am one of the leak detection dog handlers for the wastewater side for Sydney Water. So I work quite closely with Bettina, who you met before. We work Winnie and Ziggy together, and we've just got a new little pup called Eco, and she's in training at the moment. She's about 8 months old, so she's being imprinted onto Oda at the moment, and she'll be out in the field with, by the time she's about 12 months, she'll be working in the field. My background is like Nicole's, in fact. So I come from biosecurity as well and was a detector dog handler there for 6 years. I actually was in the same course as Nicole. We started together there. And then I moved over to Sydney Water 18 months ago. And I moved in because Bettina went on maternity leave. So I took on her position. And now we've got the team back together again. Now Bettina's back 2 days a week and Nicole and I are there full time. So, yeah.
So you guys are basically the three amigos.
Yeah, we are.
Totally, yeah.
Now, I guess first question I have is, how did this even begin?
Oh, the origin story.
Yes, the origin story.
Well, I better make sure I name drop the correct people because I wouldn't want to get that wrong.
Sure.
So Mark McGowan is a worker at Sydney Water and a manager, and he had heard about a water leak detection dog over in Western Australia. And then he thought, we have issues with wastewater leaks the same you would with water leaks. So he said, oh, I wonder if we can get wastewater dogs. So him and Josh Plush and Derek Cunningham met up with Steve Austin, and Steve Austin trained Winnie and Ziggy as the first wastewater leak detection dogs in Australia. And then the program started as a pilot. And then we brought on Nicole and a water dog, and now it's become the first dual unit. And there's been a lot of people who have been a part of the program. So people like Anthony Finn and Ned Thiel, and also our newer handlers, Dan and Maeve, as part of the unit. So it's been a lot of people's input to get it to where it is, as well as management with Rebecca and Ben Harris. So we've been really, really lucky to have such a supportive group.
For sure.
Because when things start off as a pilot and you're a new handler, so these two have had handling experience. So I was quite green when I started as a handler, and I think it's probably important to acknowledge that when you start a pilot program, it is very stressful and you make a lot of mistakes. But it's been really, really good to make all those mistakes nice and early, because now that the unit's up and running, we've got all these fabulous people and fabulous dogs. We now know what we're doing in the field, which has been really, really good to see over time.
Yeah. Now, was it just the random thought someone says, you know what, we should have dogs try to detect this? Only because there's obviously in this day and age, there's so many technological tools available for finding things. Was it just somebody that was interested in dogs that said, you know what, I wonder if a dog can do this? Or was it just, had it been seen before and that was why they thought dogs? I was just curious to how that even came around.
I should probably check with Mark what he was thinking, because I think it was more water leak detection dogs exist.
Yeah.
It's not up and running as a major thing across the world just yet, but can we do it for wastewater?
Yeah.
And the benefits, and you're right, there are technologies that exist for locating wastewater leaks, but dogs are fast, they're in real time, and sometimes we use fecal counts and ammonia testing to determine if something's wastewater.
Sure.
Because wastewater is not what you think wastewater is. It can be clear.
Yeah. It can be a lot of, clear and hard to tell, right?
And
visually anyway.
I'll get Kylie to tell you guys about our most recent work from the other week.
Sure.
But what didn't look like wastewater leaks?
Uh-huh.
Bang, 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 the dog's gotten it 4 times in a row.
Wow.
We've gone back the next week, and I'll let Kylie tell you that. But I think it sort of started as an idea, and now it's an up and running concept now, in practice.
Of course, now it goes into the next question of this. What is the dog smelling that's different between wastewater and water leak? What are things that differentiate these aspects, so that way we know that this dog finds this kind of leak and this dog finds that kind of leak?
Well, there's a lot of differences you'd hope between drinking water and wastewater.
But so as a typical detection dog trainer or handler, they're like, do I just go get poo water? My dog would just, but poo is different, you know? So,
sorry, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
So when we run training at work, you're right, because you can have wastewater leak detection dogs and water leak detection dogs running on the same training setup, because my control wastewater is the control for Nicole's dogs, and vice versa. So, you can have both out, and the dogs, sometimes we have calls in saying there's something leaking, we don't know what it is. Yep. You run a wastewater dog, no response. You run a water dog, no response. It's someone's pool.
Yeah.
It's not drinking water.
Yeah.
It's not wastewater.
Yeah.
Does grey water fit into wastewater?
I'm going to pass this over to Kylie.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I want to – while you were talking about that, I was very intrigued where that actually fits into the conversation, because we've got drinking water, grey water, wastewater.
So with the wastewater is literally anything that goes down your household sinks, toilets, showers, laundry.
So contaminated water.
Contaminated water. Right. So that can include things that have soap in it, detergents, tissue, obviously, because tissues, people put lots of tissues down. So anything that you could possibly imagine going down a sink.
Yep.
And that can include trade waste as well. So we've got a lot of different components put together to give a scent picture for what is essentially wastewater.
So it's not three tiers, it's two, drinking water and wastewater.
Yep. Great. That's essentially
okay,
it.
Okay, that clears it up in my mind.
We also have stormwater.
Yep.
So stormwater is stuff that, it comes down easements and then that goes into the stormwater, which ends up in canals.
How's that then clarified in this discussion?
Our dogs don't indicate on stormwater.
Right.
So there's not a scent picture there for them.
Okay.
They're not trained on that. Mm-hmm. Stormwater is essentially rainwater mixed with some dirt, things like that. It enters our stormwater, or council generally have stormwater. That enters the canals and then goes out into the rivers. But where we have issues with stormwater is if we've got breaks in our network of wastewater pipes, that will find its way into stormwater and then it comes out through the stormwater system. Essentially, stormwater pipes aren't fixed. There's cracks in them, there's holes, and they don't fix them because they're not an environmental problem. Mm-hmm. Wastewater, pipes have to be fixed, but when they crack, they find their nearest venture out, which happens to be the stormwater.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind
so
of.
So then what's the differentiating factor for the dogs between these two categories? Like, so how does the water leak dog, what is it focusing on versus the wastewater dog focusing on when it comes to odor? And then I have another question to follow on that with that, but keep going.
So essentially the water dogs are potable water. So they're looking for the chlorine and the fluoride. That is what we believe there.
So that's the picture.
That's
there.
Their scent picture. Yeah. So whereas the wastewater, there won't be any chlorine. There won't be any fluoride.
Okay.
It'll pretty much be dissipated. So they're looking for a totally different set picture. We don't know what that is at the moment.
Uh-huh.
We've done lots of trials when it comes to trying to break down the wastewater as much as we can. So using things such as controls of detergents mixed with tap water, oils mixed with tap water, tissue paper, all sorts of things, and put them out for the dogs to see if they'll react to them.
Mm-hmm.
They've all been totally fine. So the dogs, singly, they don't see that as their target odor.
So I would say stormwater and wastewater would be the hardest two things to almost differentiate because of there could be a lot of similarities there.
Yeah, that's right. And then you mix trade waste in with that as well, which goes down. So it becomes quite in-depth, quite a unique field in detection because it is quite complicated.
So the biggest thing I would say is you have to spend a lot of time in training on proofing more so than once they kind of know what the target is, then you got to do lots of proofing to kind of get them
that's
to make
right.
sure they're focusing on this.
Correct. So everything else, essentially, we want them to be indicating on effluent.
Yeah.
So, but that can also be mixed with so many different things.
Yeah.
As long as they're not hitting those things individually, such as detergent, shampoos, and they don't. The dogs are really, really good on their controls. But when they're mixed together, that scent picture changes. It now has the element of wastewater in there, and then they'll indicate on that.
And how, I mean, like, that's got to be pretty damn difficult. Most of your time, like I said, is spending that proofing stage. How hard is it to really start honing in? And it's got to be lots of repetitions, lots of in a controlled environment initially to get through that. So if you want to talk a little bit about that, because just so people can get the appreciation of this isn't something that just happens like that. It takes some time, I would imagine, to get through those controls to say it is hitting this and it's hitting this.
Yeah, we're lucky in a way that we can actually get samples of wastewater throughout the whole entire Sydney Basin. So, and those scent pictures look really different as well, because you've got different populations yeah. eating different foods in different areas mm-hmm. and the effluent has a different scent picture on top of what else is going down sinks. So we train our dogs on those odours of wastewater from all different areas. Basically, we want that commitment to odour.
Yeah.
Once they have that commitment to odour, nothing else matters mm-hmm. to them. So those other compounds and controls, they just don't mean anything at all. Yeah. So we want that commitment to odour each and every time. And, yeah, and that changes with thresholds too, right?
Of course.
You could have it spilling out, so you've got litres coming out, or it could be just tiny drips coming out that would not ever be noticed, but the yeah. dogs pick them up. Mm. So Bettina was saying about an incident that happened last week. So we were in a canal and the dogs indicated to a weep hole, which is a tiny little hole at the base of the canal. It didn't look, there was no visual indicators that it was wastewater. There was no odour associated with it, mm-hmm. But Ziggy hit it and she was like, no, it's here. And then she hit the next weep hole up. It's there. Didn't hit any other weep holes.
Okay.
We could get enough samples to take pneumonia, which was great because yeah. that's a fairly good indication that it is wastewater. And we couldn't get enough to do our normal sampling, which we take back to our labs and find out what fecal count units mm-hmm. are involved. We ended up getting the dry water leakage team, who we work with quite closely, and they came out and did some dye sampling. So essentially they go into a property that is connected to that area and they pour dye down their toilet and we watch to see where it comes out, if it comes out at all. Both came flooding out with wow. dye through those exact weep holes. None either side, just those two weep holes.
Wow.
There was no indication visually any other way and there was no odour. So the dogs absolutely hit it on point.
So how long do you have to wait to get that answer?
So that was Ziggy hit it the week beforehand and then I actually brought Winnie to see what she would do and she did the same thing. Okay. And then it took us, because it was such a slight leak coming out of the weep hole, we thought, oh, we could be here for hours waiting for this dye to come through. The dye came flooding out within 15 minutes. So every time someone pushes that toilet,
yeah.
it's flooding out of yeah. those weep holes and going straight into our waterways.
Ah.
So now it gets fixed.
Well, that's obviously a very gratifying thing that you didn't have to wait like weeks on end to find out.
Yeah.
But I imagine sometimes you do.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we can go out, the dogs can hit something. If we can get samples and we can take them back and get an indication of how much fecal count matters in there, we know within 18 hours.
Okay.
And then we can start tracing it back to source. If we can't get those kind of samples, yeah, it could take weeks.
And you guys collect the samples too, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to ask a very American question to this because this is what every American handler would do. Why can't I just train my dog on both? Can I have my one dog that finds wastewater, my one dog that also finds the normal, the water leak detection? So why wouldn't we just say one dog can do everything?
I'll hand over to Nicole.
Okay, perfect.
Because I think she hasn't had enough to say as yet.
So we considered this. Okay. We did.
Yep.
But we really wanted to make it clear exactly. We wanted to be able to take the dog out in the field, the two dogs out in the field, if we had an issue and be able to go, we run this dog and yes, that is a sewer leak. Yes, that's a water leak. Mm-hmm. So that's why we kept the individual odours. And there are similarities mm-hmm. in it.
Yeah.
So we really wanted to keep them very simple. And the wastewater dogs have a very complex odour already. Adding another odour to that, we really wanted to make it very clear to the dogs, this is what we're looking for. Yep. So that's why we kept it separate.
Such a novel concept because United States, we just want to have that one dog. And I'd probably also make it a bomb dog and a drug dog and probably a cadaver dog and a wastewater dog because why not?
Why not?
You know, lazy government bureaucratic, and that's
which is not to dig on, you know, handler mindset or trainer mindset of shoving everything into one dog. There's like what Glenn just said too. government officials would typically also like. A lot of this actually stemmed from administrations wanting to save money is the real culprit of it. And you would figure, being that you guys work for a government official kind of thing, they would say, let's be cost effective and let's just have one dog do it all. So,
well, they just don't understand, right? Yeah. So they kind of look at it from the budgetary side of things. So it's comforting for me that you as a team, first of all, that Sydney Water has taken this so seriously and they have a dedicated team to go and find, you know, where contaminants can get into drinking water and to estuaries and so forth. Like, that's comforting for me as a civilian and as a citizen of New South Wales to listen to and to hear that. The other thing that I really like, which Cameron brought up, is that you actually have a division where you do clean water and you do wastewater, or drinking water and wastewater. That's really comforting. And further to Cameron's point, I got schooled a while ago when we were talking to military people about training dogs who were both EDD trained and bite trained. And I don't like that. I don't like if you don't have to have both combined in the same unit. I don't like it. I'd rather one dog dedicated to a job and another dog dedicated to its role and purpose. However, what they explained to me was there's only so much room and weight on a helicopter, and trying to load it up with all these different dogs and personnel and handlers and everything makes it really difficult. So that, for me, dawned on me that, yes, there are logistics and reasons why that happens without the economics and the bungling of bureaucrats all arguing about how to save pennies and so forth, because they always do. It always – and it shouldn't, because it's a – you know, like when it represents the Commonwealth or the state or something like that, it should be – this is really important. It should be that we – you know, like we have a dedication to teams that are doing these sort of things. But, you know, we still have to answer to higher powers when it comes to budgets. And, you know, then people complain, well, why am I paying so much taxes? So you have to answer back to your public on that one as well. But I'd rather know that I'm not drinking sewage. I'd rather know that I'm – or wastewater. I'd rather know that I'm not drinking wastewater. I'd rather know that I'm drinking clean water, because I've got good teams like you out there in the field doing all the hard work, slogging around in unknown conditions from time to time and doing a great job for us. So thanks for that.
Yeah. And I would add to what you just said too is, you know, the multi-purpose or dual purpose or general purpose terms that get used, which is a dog does this skill, which is, say, we call it patrol work, which is, you know, tracking, apprehension, obedience kind of things. And then we have detection. And I'm very okay with, you know, those, you know, skills where they're very different types of skills in one dog. But in the detection side of things, multi-crossing detection skills, especially in something as very unique as what you guys, this is water. And there's only slightly differences in what's happening between wastewater and the actual leak, you know, normal water, I would call it, you know, clean water, or was it potable water or non-potable? Yeah. So, you know, again, going off the mindset that you had mentioned and that we talked about would be, you know, people would try to combine it all in one, but this is something without a doubt that needs to have specialties in it. You know, it should never, in my opinion, be crossed over into anything else.
Couldn't agree more.
Because we don't want to have to question which one it is. And I would imagine if you did try to combine these things, now you have to have multiple different resources all on scene to deal with it, because there's going to be wastewater is going to be handled by one group, and then, you know, the normal water is going to be handled by another group, but depending on what you're at. I'll let you guys kind of
– Yeah, totally. That. I was just thinking what you girls reckon as well. Like, in a stormwater canal area, for example, if one dog was trained on potable water leaks and wastewater leaks, you can have potable water leaks hitting canals. You can also have wastewater leaks hitting canals. So if your one dog did both and they what responded, you'd be like, well, I don't know what that is. Because as we've discussed, and I feel like Kylie and Nicole have explained it incredibly well, wastewater and potable water looks
It can look the same.
It can look different, but most of the time we're looking at it and we have no idea. Our dog response is our only backup, really. Well, the dog's right. And that's why it's nice to have, you know, lots of us with the different types of dogs, because we can all work together in the same field day, or we can do different field days. Yeah.
So I take it you guys collect the samples too. Wherever there's a leak at, you guys are the ones responsible for collecting the samples, at least initially, right? And then from there, so you guys have to be trained in the collection, and then explain a little bit about that, how that works.
Do you want to do you?
Yeah, Nicole? I can do my first.
Yeah.
So with the drinking water, the only way to 100% say this is portable water is to test for fluoride.
Okay.
So we want to look for a 1%, or 0.1% of drinking water is fluoride. So we test for that, and that'll 100% say this is water. Perfect.
Okay.
Because yes, chlorine is added as part of the treatment process to make it drinking water, capable. But the chlorine can be affected by the environment. Mm-hmm. So when the chlorine hits the UV sunlight, it can dissipate. But fluoride is not affected as much as that. So the 100% way we can test is we have a machine in the field that we can take a test on the spot and test it for fluoride. That's if we can get a sample.
Okay.
Sometimes the situation is not safe enough, or we need other acoustic equipment. We can bring acoustic equipment in to listen for the leak. And we do have that equipment. We are trained to use that as well. With the wastewater, a little bit different. Hand that to Bettina.
Sorry. Nicole, before you do that, when you talk about the environment not being safe enough, what does that resonate like?
So if I'm working, for example, by myself in the field and the leak might be in a stormwater pit, which is 3 meters deep, I'm not going to open that pit on my own and go into that pit to make that sample, because it's not safe enough for me to do so. I don't have a person that can watch and make sure that I'm if I injure myself or something like that in that hole, or if I feel that it's in long grass that is not safe enough, I might slip or fall, or I don't have the equipment to go into that area. So that's sort of what I mean by not safe to go in and do it. So we might get a specialised crew in to go in and do the sample for that scenario.
The reason I ask that question is because there's a lot of times where people don't understand the hazards that you actually face when you're doing jobs like this. Sometimes when you talk about, you know, search and rescue, or when you're talking about field jobs such as water, wastewater dogs and water detection dogs, you kind of think, oh, they're just walking along, you know, flat banks, and it's quite simple. Until you actually walk in the shoes of people who are doing this type of work, you have no appreciation. And that's, you know, when we're doing podcasts and we're telling the general public what it actually looks like, it gives them an indication of what the perils are that you have to deal with sometime. Like, I was listening to Kylie when Cameron had his seminar, and, you know, we were just riffing outside and talking about it. And she was saying that sometimes she's knee deep in mud, like trudging up and down hills. And I'm sure you've had to do likewise type of work. So detection work is very glamorous when it's all nice, but when you have to deal with the elements, like the you know, very hot days where that can affect the scent picture and the dog's capability, freezing cold days, raining, all those sort of things. I mean, obviously there are conditions where you wouldn't go out into anyway, but other people in this field who are dealing with these type of things, you just don't know what you're going to walk into sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. We, for example, I can give you a great one.
Please.
Myself and Bettina, we had a job which was on Cogra Bay, and it was windy. It was 5 a.m. Oh, it was cold, the coldest day you would ever meet.
Yep.
And we got to that environment and realized, hold on, there's oysters everywhere, and the environment wasn't suited for the dogs. We actually
– explain that, like tell people
why. With the oysters, they're sharp.
Yes.
And if the dogs run across it, they're going to cut the pads of their feet.
Yep.
So straight away we went, we're going to wait and buy booties for the dogs and train the dogs to wear booties.
Yep.
We also had to take into consideration the tide. So we had to make sure the tide was low tide before we went out, and make sure that was safe as well. We had a safe area we need to go to. But that environment was hard to work in the freezing cold weather. Your hands are cold. You've got to hold on to a lead, and you've got to take into consideration all those safety concerns before you even run the dog. It was hard work that day to try and get up early, and yeah, it was a lot of hard work. And we've been in situations like that, like in the mountains. So you gave an example with the mud, where we were going up a hanging swamp and knee deep in mud, working these dogs through ferns and whatever else we were walking through. We don't really know. And just having that physicality to it, we were grabbing, getting the dogs by the harnesses and sort of reaching them up over cliffs and rocks and things like that, it's really hard work to work in that environment. And a lot of people think, oh, I want to be a dog handler. And they think it's just holding a lead and walking a dog. But when you're working in conservation work and outside environments, in the heat, in the humidity, and you've got to take into all those safety concerns, and downhill is my nemesis. when you're working a very high-driven dog down a hill, it's a lot harder than what you think. You've really got to watch your knees and your footing and look at those appropriate shoes. And there's a lot of things you have to take into consideration. And it's hard on your body. At the end of the day, we're working up to 10 kilometres a day in these environments. It's really, really hard on your body. And we all take that into consideration and really concentrate on our fitness and health to be able to handle these dogs.
Sometimes it's nice to layer in what perspective is on job locations. I remember years ago I was involved in a security company with some colleagues of mine, and we used to added investigations to our role. And people used to say, oh, I bet that's so cool. And I said, oh, yeah, we just wear trench coats and we run around with magnifying glasses and solve murders and cases and stuff like that. I said, reality is you're sitting in a car peeing in a bottle and waiting for something to happen, which may never happen. You get cramps. You're trying not to fall asleep. Like there's a glamorous side to it when there's action happening, but there's a really non-glamorous side to it as well.
It's not Instagram.
No, it's not. It's not.
You can get your one photo with the dog with its, you know, smiling. Doesn't show the 20 photos you tried to take and you've got dog poo on your pants.
Well
and,
played.
Yeah.
Well
yeah, played. Yeah, yeah. We had like balaclavas up to our nose and gloves, and we were shivering, and yeah, it wasn't us.
You mean you're not just walking on pavement and just looking for leaks under sidewalks?
Absolutely. Not and the stormwater canal stuff, like that's pretty much as dangerous as it can get, I think. And that's why Kylie and I were grinning at each other the other week, because it is so much easier with two people, because you can have one person watching the dog and looking out for hazards while the other person's working the dog. And you know, dog responds excellent, the person keeps moving, the second handler takes a sample, you keep moving up. It was but the environmental factors are quite hard. When I was pregnant, I used to just drive really slowly behind Nicole with my hazards on because I couldn't walk up hills anymore. So, yeah, it is a very physical job, that's for sure.
Yeah, I do have people come out with me and they go, oh, I love to follow the dogs around for the day. And I think we make it about 500 metres into my run before they go, maybe I'll just drive in the car behind you.
Now, I know you were going to go into a little bit of the wastewater aspect before we get into the hazards of working the dog. I know you're going to go into something like that, so I'll let you continue.
I think it was how we collect samples.
Yes.
Is that right? Mm. So, and this is probably why wastewater dogs was a great idea, because as Nicole and Kylie have pointed out, you can't always take a sample. Yeah. There's not always liquid, so you might just have a dog response. And if we can take a liquid sample, that's where we take a sample, and it's sort of like a similar test you'd use for your pool, but it's for ammonia. Mm-hmm. So if it's positive for ammonia, there's a chance that that's sewage. And then if you've got high fecal counts, so if it's contaminated, we tend to say above 10,000 CFU per 100 mils. Is that right, Kylie? Yep, just double checking. And sometimes we'll do samples and it'll look clear. Mm-hmm. And it says 10 million CFU, blue positive for ammonia, dog response, bang, bang, bang. That's three layers. But something that I think it's what makes the dogs particularly cool is you could have an agricultural area with fertilizer. You could have runoff and you've got farm animal feces hitting the water, high CFU, blue for ammonia, no dog response. It's not human wastewater.
Uh-huh. So they're that specific to how you guys train them.
Exactly. And I think Kylie was really beautiful in the way she explained the control work, because you sort of do have to separate what goes into wastewater out a little bit. But that is how we take our samples. And our dry weather leakage team, who are being trained up as handlers as well, they'll be the most skilled people for wastewater leak detection, because they can work every single tool in their tool belt to determine, yes, this is a wastewater leak.
Now, let's get into the hazards of that, because, as we know, wastewater can have any number of different potential diseases that we have to potentially work through. So cover the risks that we go through when dealing with that aspect of exposing myself or my dog, and then obviously the collection of to know. So what's the risk with that?
Kylie?
Yes. So when it comes to a collection of wastewater, we're really particular on the WHS materials that we use. So we've always got gloves on. We've always got ethanol with us. One thing I struggle with is my whistle. So my whistle's always dangling around, and then my dog's had its nose in wastewater and then comes up and puts its nose on my whistle. And so I've got to have a spare whistle with me all the time. But we're always really particular when it comes to cleanliness. It is also a concern that the dogs are in and amongst this wastewater. So they're on probiotics that they have in the afternoons after we've been out. They get washed with F10, so we make sure that they're getting all cleaned out. We go over them with a fine tooth comb because being in canal situations, you also get leeches. It's now mandatory. We've made it mandatory, Bettina and I, that the dogs wear booties in canals as well. Because we're coming across a lot of people who feed stray cats, and there are open tins everywhere. And people love to throw glass into canals, and there's smashed glass everywhere. And depending on what dog we have, we'll run them off lead as well. So they might get 30 metres ahead of us. We don't know what 30 metres ahead looks like.
Yeah.
So it's really important that they've got their OH&S stuff on as well. And when we get back, everything gets ethanoled. Including ourselves. And sometimes.
And I was going to ask, so with you're dealing with the dogs that have to be deconned, basically, you have to go at the end of the day, and is there a decon procedure that you guys do to, because this now gets into breed types to consider if someone's going to do something. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, we choose Springer Spaniels and Cocker Spaniels. We try to keep them all fairly well shaven, especially when you're talking about the wastewater dogs, because we want them to be as clean as possible. Having long ears can be a little bit of a problem, but generally we get back out of the field, everything gets taken out of the back of the truck, everything, their harnesses, leads, our pouches, everything gets decontaminated, and the dogs get decontaminated as well. So, yeah, it's just general procedure.
Yep.
What about waterborne pathogens like Giardia and so forth? How do you deal with those sort of things when you're in those sort of areas?
Yeah, we haven't had to deal with that. I don't know if either of the girls have had to deal with that.
Actually, it's probably important to note we have incredibly strict hand hygiene. It's like a team cultural thing as well as a safety thing as well. So in regards to sewage, it's like if you're wastewater, if you're handling bottles, gloves, like Kylie mentioned. But I think I have a bit of a rule that if you're bringing lunch to work, bring a fork.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. We have water on the back of the cars and soap. So I know it probably doesn't sound as cool as like a big massive spray on disinfectant element, but it's like we have hand sanitizer gels everywhere. If anything, we get quite dry hands doing our work because we're constantly washing our hands. We're constantly sanitizing, sort of like being a nurse or a doctor and you're in a hospital. It's that level of
If only hygiene. We had some training for that before all this.
Yeah, the pandemic actually set it up really well, but the dry weather leakage and wastewater dog teams, we were already ready to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the good thing is going into this detail of explanation. I guarantee by this point in the podcast, we've lost half the people that thought at first were like, I want to go do that. Now they're like, okay, there's got to be something I can do that's
saving the environment is not as pretty as it looks on TV. It's exactly. Not all a David Attenborough documentary. Yeah.
Right?
It's very dirty work and you can't edit it. There is no editing when you're out in the field.
Yeah.
It's dirty. And the dogs, you know, you imagine the dogs have just had a win and our dogs, the wastewater dogs get paid 100% of the time because we can't determine at that point what is – if they're correct or if they're
That's
not.
That's huge. So say that again. Your dogs get rewarded in the field and you don't know the answer yet?
Nope. 100% of the time they are rewarded.
Oh, I need to sit back and – because this
can
is like a shocking thing.
Absorb that, Cameron. Absorb it.
We're very good at reading our dogs. So, you know – if they've been, and with the wastewater dogs, they could be working a whole day and not get a reward.
Yeah.
Because we haven't come across any leaks.
Sure.
So that can be a really unrewarding time for them. One little girl, a little black cocker spaniel, she'll sometimes try it on, but we know from her behavior whether she's right or wrong.
Yeah.
So our dogs are, I would like to say, pretty honest.
Yeah.
But they're going to try it. You know, they've been working all day and they've been working hard and they haven't had one ball yet. I mean,
so I got to ask the question that's going to be everybody's number one thing. Well, aren't you completely fearful and scared that if you rewarded on something that wasn't your odor, your dog is now broken?
Nope.
Oh, my God.
My dog's not broken and my dog will be fine and my dog will do a really good job the next day.
Yeah.
I mean, if we come into situations where they were false responding on one thing and one thing only, obviously we go back and we do corrective work on that and testing, but we don't, touch wood, have that issue. I can honestly say our dogs are pretty good and well, I don't have back a to problem.
Your training.
Yeah.
You have sound training and you trust your dog.
And we read our dogs really well.
Exactly.
Our dogs all have real tell signs when they're correct. And generally, if they're not, you'll just look at them and go, come on, Winnie. And she'll go, oh, okay then. And she'll just walk off and go, okay, we'll keep finding stuff. So, they're pretty honest.
You know, that's one of the things that I really love about a good handler dog team is when you have that congruency between each other. And you connect on a level that's it's hard to understand until you're actually with a dog and you've been working with it during that period of time. Like you know when a dog is true to its disciplines, or whether it's just jerking you around on the day. Like I love when I see a handler who is that in sync with their dog. It's truly magical. It's something that has to be seen. You can't explain it to people. Well, you can, but until you see it, like when you really see it, when you walk the shoes with somebody and you're in the field with them and you can see them, like you think, oh, your dog's indicating. They go, nah, the dog's just jerking around. And then when the dog's truly on odor and it's working like it should work, you go, now it's on odor, now it's working the exact way it should. And that is, as Cameron said, that takes time. It's like any sport that you're doing or any discipline that you actually partake in, it takes time to actually understand the mechanics of it. And when you do, like you're set, but it's still experience and perspective that's going to actually achieve that.
Oh, it is. Absolutely, Glenn. And it is a great thing when you know your dog that well.
Yep.
It's really powerful, especially in the field that we're in, because we don't have those indicators to let us know whether the dog's correct or not. So we've really got to trust our dog. We've really got to train our dogs in a way that the dogs are honest. But in saying that, we love our dogs to be naughty too. And there's nothing wrong with them wanting to give it a go. As long as we know. Yeah. Like we can read them properly. So no, it doesn't break our dogs and it doesn't break us.
I've never met a faultless dog, never. No, I've never met a dog, you know, whether it's in law enforcement or detection work or anything, or a sport dog that is faultless.
No.
You know, it just doesn't exist. Like they can be better and they can be trained better. And Cameron hit it on the head before and so did you, Kylie, when you basically said when you trust your dog and you know that all your foundation skills have been set for the dog to do its work and do it well – then that's where the true magic happens. And it's not magic, it's preparation. You know, it's like that saying when people said, oh, you were lucky. Well, I wasn't lucky. I just did a lot of hard work and the opportunity collided. And all of those paradigms sort of met in the middle and we got a really good synergy from it. And that's what it is. It between you and the dog, it's a synergistic relationship where the two of you have just collided well together. Training, opportunity, lots and lots of hard work and just a fraction of luck sometimes.
And we're quite a powerful unit, I would say, because we do training days and we watch each other and we take turns and we film each other.
Yep.
So sometimes there might be parts of yourself that you're like, I don't understand. The training's really sound. We're not, you know, false responding. Why am I having this issue? And you don't know until your colleague has got video recordings and you're like, oh, I just tapped my hat. I tap my hat right before my dog hits the target in training. And that's obviously the importance of double blinds. So we do a lot of double blind work.
Mm-hmm. Key.
So, yeah, you have to, and we try to make training, unless you know there's a particular issue we're trying to solve, we try to make training harder.
Yes.
So when they hit the field, it's easy.
Yep.
And that's, I totally agree.
Yeah, it's a key point. I mean, you're hitting all the important things, as you guys already sat in my lecture, know what I'm talking about, is making training and reality blend together as part of the concept. Second thing is, it's not about, you guys don't focus so much on the indication, you're focusing on the odor. And by focusing on the odor, you're then able to read your dog to the point that you made, I know my dog's on odor because I have seen it so many times and it looks like these characteristics, not just waiting for constantly the perfect freeze or sit or whatever it is people do. You are hitting the most important thing is I know the behaviors that are indicative to the dog alerting to the odor that it's trained to detect.
Yeah. I mean, our dog might not be able to actually get to that odor, but they're indicating to us the odor is a meter away or half a meter away. My dogs will be climbing canal walls. So they're not doing their normal response of a drop and nose on. They can't get there. They can't do it. But I know from their behavior, that is what I'm after. Yeah. That's an indication. It doesn't have to be that traditional indication of what they would normally do if they can get to the odor. But their body language, their behavior tells me that, it's still an indication.
That's an important aspect, I think, that sometimes gets lost in training. Training looks a lot at the alert behavior. Everybody just wants to focus on a pretty indication what that looks like versus going, okay, what is my dog going to do when odor isn't in the perfect way, which is like you just talked about. It's in a condition that they can't get to, but they can smell it. It's the environment itself is so unique and different that they can't do the thing, the behavior, because of the environment. And I know you guys, we were talking about a story that occurred where I guess there was a team that was looking for a leak for 3 days.
Oh, that was the Blue Mountains job. Yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, there was accessibility issues. And they'd been trying to look for it for weeks, wasn't it? I can't quite remember.
Yeah, it was a few days. I think it was
3 days. Anyway, Nicole and I rocked up and two women with two cute looking dogs.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we were taken very seriously, to be honest.
Yep.
But within the hour, we'd located it. And we got a lot of work off the back of that.
So they were there for 3 days, digging around, looking for a leak, using all of this expensive equipment.
And a lot of people.
Yeah.
So people cost.
Yep. And then two
people,
of you show
two people, two dogs.
45 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So it was a great day and it was cold. Yeah. You know, if we're going to go back to the whole, it's not all fun. It was a fun day, but crawling through mud.
We went through the mud.
I think that's how we gained respect, to be honest.
Yeah, we just went straight up the hill.
And didn't you say you're up to your knees in mud?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Trying to get through all that stuff.
Yeah. We just went, okay, that's uphill. Where we need to go. Yeah. We're up there and yeah.
Well, I kind of want to circle back to what you were talking about before and what the girls alleged about the non-glamorous side to it. I'm kind of glad that that knocks people out from wanting to do it because you really don't want to have people who are precious turning up that want to do this job. And then, you know, like you have to go through all that training, all that preparation, and they find, oh, I don't like doing all this messy work. I'd rather know that if I was leading a project like this, I'd rather know that I've got people who understand, you know, like this is dirty, it's dangerous, it's, you know, like it's not glamorous. You're getting covered in all sorts of yucky stuff. And that's part of the job role and part of the job description. I'd rather know that I've got a hardy person that goes, look, this is going to be you know, a bit of a shit show sometimes. I've just literally got to roll up my sleeves, literally, and I've just got to roll up my sleeves and get into it. That way, when you get, you know, midway into the job, you haven't got somebody who wants to quit. I mean, it's fantastic that the three of you are taking this so seriously that you've had to endure, you know, shitty conditions, leeches, cold weather, horrible, you know, up to your knees in mud, and yet your dogs are still finding. And Nicole, one thing that I really love listening to you telling your story during Cameron's seminar was one of your dogs or your dog hit a leak that was 6 meters below surface or something like that. Was that true? Or?
That was a wastewater dog. So one of the wastewater dogs found a leak that was 6 meters down. The water dogs find leaks up to 2 meters down underground.
Incredible.
So without any visuals on
incredible.
Surface. So that's smelling it through the soil. And I think that's so fascinating.
I do too. I love it.
Because then you've got to look into it and go, okay, what soil type is I investigate and go, okay, how did the dog do this? How did the dog get through this soil? What soil type was it? Does it make it easier, the different types of soil, because they're more dense. The sandy soils are more open so the odour would get through better. The other one is through bitumen, so on roads.
Wow.
If there's a crack in the road, the odour's able to come through. So the dogs are able to smell it. And we've had situations where there's been a leak under a road and they've drilled holes in random places and the dogs are able to pinpoint exactly where it is rather than digging up the whole road to find out exactly where the location is.
Doesn't that just show us how amazing dogs are? Like, they're just incredible when they're doing and performing skills like that on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah. That leads me to the type of dog. What type, I mean, can't I just show up? My dog loves to sniff. My intention is I want to save the world and the environment. What can I do? Can I just bring Fifi over and do this? Or do you guys look for certain qualities or characteristics, motivations in a dog to do this very unique type of work?
Definitely characteristics is really important because you've got to look at where the environment we're going to work these dogs. So having a smaller, compact, lighter dog works ideal for us because then we're able to, you think of a stormwater canal, for example, it's quite deep to get into a stormwater canal and you're going to climb down ladders to get into it. So we need a dog that we're able to lower down safely and take into consideration manual handling.
So not a huge dog isn't going to be beneficial.
Yeah, exactly.
You need a smaller one. Okay.
So having that small, agile dog, ideal for the environments we're working in. The breed itself, we use springers, working line springers and working line cocker spaniels because it's in their breed to hunt.
Yes.
All our dogs have constantly got that nose to the ground. And when we're selecting puppies, we look for a couple of things. We look for a happy, healthy puppy, number one. Two, we're looking for a dog that is hunting. Just recently when we went down to look at Eco and chose Eco, she was nose to the ground constantly. We threw food into a long grass and she did not give up until she found that food in that long grass. We want to look for something that's playful. So we threw a ball. So we brought a ball along and we threw the ball and seen if the puppies would chase the ball. And this whole litter of puppies we saw, well, all the females in the litter, of course.
Yeah.
We threw the ball and those puppies at 8 weeks of age brought that ball back to us and were happy and really eager to do that. So we look for those little characteristics in the dogs when we're choosing them. So it's all that, I guess, Bettina, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Oh, I don't think I can. I think that's a fantastic summary.
Yeah, it really is. I just wanted to add to that as well. The point that you made about having to habituate your dog to wearing a harness and having to be repelled down into areas.
Yeah.
Like, that's another thing that people wouldn't take into consideration. You know, when you're talking about the type of dog and the character of the dog and the hardiness of the dog, you know, like a lot of times when I'm considering a dog for an application, it's the construct of the dog. Like, can I take all of this that's going to actually happen to me? Because it's not only a dog that will socialize to an environment but also habituate to it as well and have that sort of malleability about it. And that's so important that people don't consider, because if you get a sketchy little dog that doesn't like that side of the job, that immediately eliminates the dog. So you can go through all that hard work and then realize, oh, my dog doesn't like being lowered into stormwater drains, safe stormwater drains and so forth, but it doesn't like having to wear a harness and be lowered in. Like, that affects its job capability and so forth. Very important for people to understand that.
Yeah. When we get the dog at 8 weeks of age, we spend a lot of time bomb-proofing that dog. So the dog goes home with Nicole because she's got the space at home to puppy raise. It's around all kinds of animals, around people, kids, toddlers, goes out to shopping centres once it's had all its vaccines. So it's going around traffic, trucks, trains, whatever we can put that dog in different environments, we put the dog in different environments.
You know, Cameron said that at his seminar too, where he was talking about working your dog beyond the environment, which I really thought was a point, because people work up to the environment sometimes, not beyond the environment. And if you're not working beyond the environment, that's where you start finding, oh, now I've got a major issue, which is preventing me from doing the job.
Yeah, well, with our dogs, I mean, we work in national parks, we work in beaches, we work on riversides, we work in bays, canals, residential, rural. So we're doing a lot of different environments, and we want to make sure that all of our dogs are happy to work in those environments first and foremost.
Yeah.
The new puppy, she is bomb-proof. She's almost too confident with everything. She's not scared of anything.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah, I think there is. So she's, yeah, she's doing really, really well. But to us, we need to have those dogs that we can take into any environment because we could be called to anywhere.
Yeah.
And we don't want them spooking out over anything. We want them to be happy while they're working. If they're happy and they're working, they're going to produce, you know, really good work. So
where I think that application does fits well is sound, where you said it could be too overconfident, is when a dog doesn't take into consideration its own personal safety. And sometimes they don't know what that is.
Absolutely.
But other times they do, and they're reckless. Like a dog will jump over a cliff.
Absolutely.
There's a picture of a German Shepherd jumping over a cliff to get a seagull. It's like one of those, and people meme it, you know. But if a dog is that silly and reckless about its life, that's where I see a dog is too overconfident or too reckless or too drivey for its own good. It's one of those hard ones. It's a real paradigm where you kind of look at it and you think to yourself, you know, like, I want everything from this dog, but also I want some common sense as well. And we're kind of describing the perfect dog.
Well, that's why we bring in the obedience and we use whistles. So their recall has to be 100% perfect 100% of the time.
Yep.
We use a stop whistle as well. So if we see something near ahead, we use a whistle that they stop on the spot. They don't move. So we've got to make sure if we're taking them out, especially in areas that we're not putting them online, that they stop when told to stop.
We all need to be governed for our
own
good.
They recall when we tell them to recall. So that is really, really important to us. Yes, our dogs are confident.
Yep.
And as I said, this little Eco is probably overconfident, but what goes hand in hand with that is to make sure that her obedience is up to scratch and that she does what she's told to, abides by her commands 100% of the time.
Well, that's what I was talking about before. For her own safety. Yeah, that's what I was talking about before with that synergistic relationship.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the synergy between a handler and their dog is important. Otherwise, the dog doesn't know – pardon me. Otherwise, the dog doesn't know how to govern itself.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So would you guys prefer, or do you guys always start with puppies and go from puppy to adulthood? I mean, other than I would probably say maybe your initial dog might have been, as this program got started, obviously an adult. But from that point, did you guys from there say, I'd much rather go the puppy raising route versus getting a two-year-old or what have you?
So the reason why we went down the puppy route was because you've got that critical learning phase between that, like 6 and 16 weeks, basically.
Absolutely.
And I really wanted to capture that, particularly because we have to have such a solid dog in the field. We're taking it into environments where they could have dogs off lead. We could have birds, cats chasing me. I've had a cat chase me as well. Whole different story.
Sure.
But I really wanted to shape that puppy. And I do a lot of work as soon as I get that puppy. Although they haven't got all the other injections, there's so much you can expose them to at that point to really set up a confident little puppy to when they are able to get out into the environments we are working, it's not going to be such an impact if they do have a little bit of a fright or they do see something new. They've already had those little bits of experiences in the beginning. Mm-hmm. If we get an older dog, we don't know what that's happened in that critical learning phase. And we don't really have the time to deal with some behavioural issues that might come with that before that. So we kind of want to shape our own dogs to be able to be ideal for the environment when we are start working them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, it's such an important, like you just said, a developmental stage is those early stages. It's not so much about detection. It's about getting the dog, like you guys say, bomb-proof for the environments and the things that they're going to potentially have to work in and or face when they're out there operationally. So getting a head start on that, and there's going to be, I guarantee, things that you guys do that's going to be custom tailored to the operational world versus a different detection discipline. They're not all the same. So it's a good thing to kind of highlight it. It's more about the developmental aspects in those early ages as you get older. Now, This leads to the training question. So first question is, how old are they when you guys start your formalized training? And then second, how long is it typically in time?
So when we'll use Hydro, for example, because he was our first one that we trained. So in terms of that early stage, it was more environmental training.
Sure.
So in that initial stage, we started the more formal training, I want to say about that 6 month mark. Okay. Where we might start a bit more stricter obedience and a bit more asking a little bit more of the dog. And we just start introducing the odor there as well, just a little bit of introduction mm-hmm. so that they learn that this is a positive thing going to sniff this odor in the most straightforward way.
Yeah.
By 9 months, we've got them in the field going, here's some live leaks and this is what we need to do when we find a live leak. Then Hydro probably was starting really working in the field. We work our way up. So he's still a developing puppy really in the adolescent stage. So we don't want to put them in the environment where they're going to get injured while they're still growing and all that sort of stuff. So we work up their kilometers, their distances, and make sure they're in the physical state that by 18 months, they're fully operational and able to do the kilometers. And now Hydro is getting to that point now where he's doing sort of the similar Ks that Joey's doing, who's fully operational as well. So we really take the time to develop when we swim the dogs, making sure they're nice and strong. We build that fitness up. We build that endurance of hunt up. And it's very important to take your time in doing that. And each individual dog is different. Eco's been a little bit different. She's a bit of a wild child, being a Cocker Spaniel. She's just not as mature. Like I thought Hydro, like he hit that nine and 12 months, I wasn't sure. That dog was like really hard to kind of get his little mind together. And at 12 months, a light bulb went in him and he goes, oh, this is what you want me to do. Where Eco, he's very distracted by the hunt. So we're using the pre-mac work with her because she loves to hunt.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. She just has her nose to the ground the entire time. So she might take a little bit longer, I think, to get her into field work, to get her concentration. We sort of develop it around the individual dog.
And how old is she right now?
She's 7 months.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're, yeah.
Yeah. So we're still early on with her. And we've just, we started her on odor and then we took her off and go, okay, we're not getting what we're seeing here.
It's a good point to make about that, because a lot of people might want to stay working odor, where your ability to go, hold on, let's stop for a second and go into working on this thing separately. So there's not a bleed over or risk to my odor work.
Yeah. We need to make it very clear. We need to make sure the dog's ready.
Yeah.
Because if you start it too early and you start confusing the dog, or the dog's just not ready to understand what you're asking of it, like there's no point. I don't think you've really got to be able to read that dog and know where they're up to and be able to adjust to that. And I think that's part of the art of dog training, really. And you've got to accept that. Like a lot of people don't want to accept it. They go like, oh, this is the dog. I want to train it. I want to get it up to this level. And the last dog we trained was like this. And we can't panic about that. We're going to go, no, let's go take a step back and go, this is what we need to do.
Do you know there's a business saying called P versus PC, which is production versus production capability. And it talks about people actually being ready to do the job versus having to do the job. And, you know, like I've traveled around a little bit. I got to watch some of the law enforcement groups in the UAE working their dogs, where they don't have a lot of crime. So they actually get a lot of time to actually prepare and practice for when they're going out and doing work. Where I've worked with other agencies who they're on the job all the time. You know, like they're not only having to do detection work, they're actually having to serve warrants, arrest criminals, patrols, all those sort of things. So it's very hard, and Cameron's far more experienced in this, me being an ex-copper himself and working with worldwide agencies and so forth. It's very hard to find that perfect balance between P and PC, production and production capability. But, you know, you can't have production without production capability, where the animal actually knows its role and how to do it, as does the handler. And you're both entirely confident with each other, like you know what you're doing and you know how to do this. but then trying to convince your bosses who really don't understand it but are looking at the monetary side of training and, you know, all the utilities that need to be invested in it. And I think, you know, I use the word, I'm overusing that word, but the synergistic side of it where the bosses really need to go out sometimes in the field, if that's at all capable, where they're actually walking with you and saying, oh, now I see where the money needs to go. Now I see where the investment in training and equipment and personnel needs to come from, because this is far more difficult than what I envisaged it to do. But that in itself, you know, to get people to step out of the ivory tower sometimes, and I'm not picking on anyone in particular, I'm just saying as a constructive feedback for people in those sort of areas, because sometimes people in those roles feel attacked. They go, well, now, you know, like I'm trying to do everything for my team, but they sometimes just need to walk the shoes or at least have an advisor that goes, oh, yeah, I've been out on the field with them. It's hard, you know, and I understand now where that true investment needs to come from. But, you know, Cameron, I'm pointing to you,
yep.
You've seen this, like you've walked in those shoes and you've trained so many people around the world, you know, far more than I have, and you've seen that for yourself multiples of times.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, and it's regional too. Mm. You know, certain areas do it this way. It was like the podcast I did recently with the Austrian police canine handlers. And there's some overlaps that you guys do, which is the dogs, you have to, it's a lengthy period of time. So, and going by your guys' numbers, the dogs are probably in training for, just like you told me, close to 10 months before they're even operational. Now, speaking with from Austrian to Australian, the certification aspects. Now, do you guys have like an in-house certification? Does certification include, or even evaluation, whatever you guys want to call it, handler skills, such as, obviously, this is extremely important to me, the handler be able to go into the environment, look around, and see if there's hazards before I even begin. That would be like the first thing. Can you do this? Another part would be, just like you guys keep talking about, the obedience aspect. A critical component for your guys' detection is, I would say, obedience, as you mentioned. That ability to stop the dog or recall the dog are huge components just for safety, you know, in this aspect. Before I go too far, I'll let you guys just kind of hit those things. Do those numbers sound correct? And then explain any kind of evaluation that you guys might have.
So the numbers are correct, about 10 months, I would say, in terms of that structured training. In terms of evaluation, because we are a very small team, we work together and we test each other a lot. Between the three of us, we are very critical of the way we handle the dogs.
Sure.
And when we don't put them in the field, we always talk to each other going, okay, do you think the dog is ready for us to come and expose them to field? And we sort of do our own, I guess, in-house evaluation in terms of whether the dog is ready and how we're going to introduce them to the environment. And that will depend on dog at this point. That's how we're doing it. We do have Steve Austin that comes in, and he actually will train with us as well, and he'll actually have a look at the dog and see where it's up to and whether he thinks that we need to work on something individually. And that's really good. I think the number one thing is we're good at talking to each other and good at actually taking not criticism, feedback in relation to what we're doing. Yeah. And if something's not going to plan, we kind of talk it through and go, okay, how can we change this and how can we be ready? And we see, and if we start seeing our figures and looking at our figures and how our dogs are working and they're underperforming, then we sit down and have a conversation about it.
Yeah.
And I think having that open conversation and working for other organizations, it's really hard to be so focus on this is how we do things and this is how we must test each other. I think it's, if we speak it as a bigger group, you're going to have so many more options to be able to improve on what you do.
Adaptability is key, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're only a small team at this point. So it'll probably move to the point where now that we're training new handlers, we're actually talking about how we're going to evaluate those handlers and how we're going to set up a structure and how we're going to test them to be field ready as handlers. So yeah, that's in the process.
The on or off leash, how much would you guys say is on leash versus off leash?
Well, I feel like it depends on the job, doesn't it?
Mine is 95% of the time.
It depends on the dog and on the job.
Okay.
So if I'm working in a canal with Bettina and we have Ziggy with us, Ziggy is off 100% of the time.
Okay.
Unless it's we see something before we start that we go, no, look, we need to put her on leash. And it might be that we're in a canal and 100 metres of that canal goes under a road. She gets put on leash at that time because I can't see that the light's way too dark. Could be anything in there. So then she's on leash and then she's off leash. Winnie is on leash all the time. She's a naughty little thing. She's great at a dog, but she's a naughty little thing. So she's on leash all the time for her own safety. And she's also not – she's a very methodical dog. She's not a quick – I wouldn't class her as a quick dog. She's probably quick to a lot of detection dogs out there. But in comparison to Ziggy and Joey, she's not quick. So for my safety – and for Bettina's safety, it's actually better for us to run Ziggy off a leash because she is going quick. And we're on slippery surfaces, rocky surfaces, uneven surfaces. That dog can move through those environments and knows where to go really, really well. So they're much better on their feet when I'm not hindering them with a lead, pulling them backwards and pulling them on off odor because I can't keep up. And Ziggy always comes around and checks back in. So she'll do 20 meters up and then she'll come back and she'll do a loop. And if there's something there, I'll just call her in with a whistle so it's all good. Eco, we hope to have her as an off-leash dog as well just because I think the dogs work a lot better with us without us interfering with their hunt. Let them go. Let them hunt. Yeah. Let them do what they need to do. So,
And when you're on leash, what size leash would you say typically?
So, again, depends on environment. But if I'm in a fairly open space, I like to be on a 5 to 7.
Okay. And for those audience, meter.
Yes, sorry, foot. 5 to 7 meters.
No, only because I always say that because I know my audience would be like, 7 foot? Okay.
Yeah, no, that's nothing. No, 5 to 7 meters.
That's a good
and then
distance.
In more confined areas, especially if you've got a lot of trees and things like that, probably a bit shorter, more like a three meter.
Do you use a flexies or do you use just a straight lead?
We use – actually, I'll let Nicole tell you because she makes the leads and she
special water leak detection leashes. Got it.
It's like I couldn't find the lead I wanted, so why not make
it
myself?
Smart.
So we wanted a lead that we could take into the water and it would obviously wouldn't go moldy. So I looked at marine rope. So it's a special marine rope that you can wet and it dries out quick. And so – I sort of made my length lead the way I wanted. My dogs are on lead 95% of the time because I work in a lot of industrial areas, residential areas, and it's just not safe enough to have them off lead. So I have different lengths of lead depending on, again, my environment. You've got residential areas that have got a lot of trees. A 10-meter long line is the most stressful thing when you've got the tangled lead around the trees and the dog's trying to zigzagging out. So I might put them down to the 3-meter lead in that circumstances where I can get around the trees and still have a safe working dog or I have a 5-meter lead. So I'll sort of I have 5, 3, and 10 depending on my environment, but 95% of the time I have that. And I have knots, which Bettina doesn't like, but I have knots in my lead, which I don't know. The way my dog works, I know where I need to hold the lead. Sure. I know where those knots, what those knots mean and how I can keep them safe. It drives Bettina nuts because she's in light knots.
You two with the knots in your lead. Oh, my goodness.
I'm with you, Bettina. I'm not a knot person.
No, they get caught on stuff. Anyway.
And I don't like leads with handles because the handles get caught on things. Sure. And so I like a straight rope. And I don't like the G-clamp type scenario. I don't think they're strong enough. So I buy a stronger clamp.
So like a carabiner dogs. Type snap?
Not carabiner. Okay. It's sort of like a claw clamp, I think it's called.
Yeah.
So it overlaps each other.
Aha.
And it's very strong. Yep. I haven't had a lead break on me yet. Yeah. So I'm doing all right.
Sounds like it's a great little design and it came out of a specialty need that you guys have. Because I would think my first thought would be biothane because it is easy, but is there a downside to the biothane?
We've had the biothane, but we find that they do break down. Like I find them, they crack and they break down a bit easier. We haven't had these type of leads break on us, or unless the dog has eaten through it.
Yeah, which never happens, right?
Never happens. Our dogs are perfect. But in the field, if I'm working it, it's a very strong rope,
yep.
a marine rope that has it can take a lot of
What about burning
pressure.
Your hands with rope? yes.
It depends on the dog. I wear gloves the entire time so I don't get rope burn with that type of rope. But, yeah.
It's something that
– It protects my hands. Yeah. But, yeah, it depends on the dog. Some dogs work lovely and they'll just work loosely on the lead. Joey just like goes straight – heading to work, I need to work right now and you need to keep up with me. And that's the way he works. So I have to wear my gloves with him. Hydro, don't necessarily have to wear the gloves with him. He's more methodical in his hunt and slows down a little bit more. So, yeah.
Here's the big question now. Need. What is the need? Do you guys get called out once a month? Do you guys work once? Because, again, with this being a new field, I think the biggest thing is the education of, in your guys' case, the consumer, the person, the companies that need water leak, they don't think dogs right now. So how much consumer education? And then two, how much do they need you? Do you guys go out? Like I said, what's the frequency of this?
We go out. So I have a certain amount of kilometers of main I need to cover per year.
Okay.
So to do that, I at least have to go to 3 to 4 days a week out in the field working the dogs. The sewer team's a little bit different. They don't have a kilometer, but they have certain jobs they needed to complete within a certain time frame. I guess Bettina can explain that.
Yeah, I think the wastewater work is what predominantly 80% reactive, 20% planned, but it's changed a lot over the time. So that's me based off a couple of years ago, whereas there's more planned work now. So I think it's just the nature of wastewater leaks. You have to get them fixed very quickly. And we might get unique jobs like odor complaints.
Yeah.
So, somebody might be complaining of a funny smell and we run the dogs out there and see if we can locate it.
In a month for wastewater, how often do you say average you get called?
Or what do you reckon, Kylie?
It really depends. So our program is quite complex in the way that we do odor complaints, we do reactive work, we do what's called saltwater ingress work, we go and do condition assessments of rising mains, plus we go into proactively look for leaks in stormwater canals. We could do residential as well. So we're across a whole heap of different leakage programs, I guess you could say. When I haven't got people emailing me saying we've got an odor complaint or can you come out and do a condition assessment, I plan my own work in amongst those different programs. So we try to be out in the field at least 3 days a week, if not four. Mm-hmm. Our reporting's a little bit harder as well because we will be finding things that don't necessarily have an address attached to them. They're in a stormwater canal. So we've got to take GPS locations. We've got to put them into mapping. We have a look at that on our network and pinpoint that onto mapping on our network. So our reporting's a little bit more complex as well. So I'd say a day and a half when it comes to reporting, training, and then let's say three and a half days in the field.
Yeah, that's a full-time job.
So you're not just running around the field with dogs?
No, funny about that.
So that means do you guys get to work with the water companies? Basically, you guys are giving like blueprints of where pipes are at throughout the city or
whatever. So we have what's called Spatial Hub, and that gives us a mapping of our water network. So both wastewater network and potable water network. And we do have stormwater networks in there as well. So we can look at that mapping system. And we've got a few other mapping systems too, which is also a great thing. So we might do a desktop analysis before we even go out. So someone will ring us and say, we've got an odor complaint. Can you come out there and have a look? Before we even go out with the dogs, we've got to do a desktop analysis to see if it's worthwhile because we might drive two hours and go, we can't run the dogs there. It's not going to work. So we'll bring up a whole heap of mapping that we're able to look at through our different systems and zone in on places and go, looks like we can run the dogs there. Or, no, we really can't because the topography is really, really steep. We're going off cliffs. Yeah. It could be on main roads or – Yeah,
so you guys, for let's say, to be a water leak detection dog, there's the call, the need, then pre-planning, then deployment if it meets the criteria, then after deployment, collection of collection of data or collection of sampling as well, mm-hmm. going back, charting that out per the map, then submitting a report back up.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the last three parts of that probably have to happen pretty quickly because they want this problem solved.
Yeah, that especially with wastewater. So we don't want wastewater leaking down the environment, obviously for environmental reasons, public health. So those issues really need to get fixed quite quickly. Yeah. So we want to get that reporting back to the people that have asked us to go out and do the jobs.
You know, I just realized you guys will never be out of a job because literally some of the pipes are just made out of old ceramic piping. Some of them, you know, like ground shifts, roots grow into pipes, seismic activity, all of those things, anything that can move and shift ground and displace piping and runoffs and so forth, it's never ending.
And it's a big thing. Sydney Water's got a lot of older assets depending on the suburbs that you're in. So you're looking at, as you said, different types of pipes.
200 years of aqueducts.
That's right. Yep. And so there's always places to go out. There's always leaks.
Yep.
It's trying to find these leaks when they're really tiny before they become
really big.
Really big. And that's what the dogs are exceptional at. They find things before they become a big problem. So we get in there early and,
And you guys work, instead of working for a private company, you guys actually work for the water district, basically, the company that runs the
water. We work for Sydney Water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the dogs are owned by Sydney Water and we work for Sydney Water.
Yeah. Because what I envision is in different, again, regions, it could depend, companies who have been hired by water districts to find leaks may also have interest in the utilization of dogs to be a part of their assets to, you know, work with a water management district. Because, you know, I look at the point of view from the United States would be there'd be a lot of water districts that would not want to own any assets like this. They'd much rather farm it out to a company and then just be billed accordingly. So it's very unique and actually really special, the fact that you guys actually get to work with the Sydney Water to do this kind of work versus because commercialized, now it becomes, well, I'm not going to pay you so much. I just need a dog handler. A company's going to cut corners. It is what it is. They're going to want to do it as cheap as possible, but bill as high as possible. When you're just a cog in the wheel, you're just an employee. You're just a piece of equipment at the end of the day. So you guys being in the position that you're in, you're actually viewed as an asset versus a piece of equipment. And that's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. And Sydney Water's liable to the EPA as well. So they've got conditions that they've got to meet with the network. And as part of that, the dogs can come in and help meet those conditions.
Yeah.
So it's really, really important for us to do our job right. And Sydney Water's been extremely, extremely supportive of what we do and how we do it.
So,
really, really thankful for the support that they give us and allowing us to make decisions as trainers and handlers for what's going to make the program better, move forward, improve, grow. So, we're very fortunate.
Well, I think all the residents of Sydney are probably appreciative to you and Sydney Water that we're not having a nice glass of poo water.
Yeah. Well, let's take this as I wrap this up with this. Let's talk numbers. This is a data question now. What is the data? Are dogs more effective than the tools that are currently available out in the field? And efficiency, putting teams out there, is this more efficient than current abilities that exist?
I think the way we've got to look at it is the dogs are a tool, like a tool in a toolbox of things that Sydney Water have. So there's lots of different ways they do leak detection within Sydney Water. And this is what's great because they always look for innovative ways they can look for leak detection. What makes them individual is each thing has its strengths and weaknesses. And that's where the dogs come in. And the strengths they have is being able to find those small leaks before they become big. And it's very hard to compare how more effective they are than traditional methods. Yes, we can have a look at kilometres, how many leaks per kilometre, but there's certain other aspects we need to take into consideration in what environment they may be working in, how many kilometres they had done, how many leaks they had found, the type of leaks they had found compared to the type of leaks we find. We find a lot of small leaks. They might find some bigger leaks, mm-hmm. but we find the small leaks before they get big. And that's really important. So I've been had a great start to this financial year, I should say. For example, this month I found a leak every 350 metres.
Wow.
Last year I found a leak every 2.3 kilometres on average over the year, which is a great result in terms of finding those smaller leaks.
Now, what about machines? In comparison to that exact same standard you just gave, or how is the mechanical version of this? Are they just as effective or is it not as proficient based on the data you have so far?
Yeah, so the machines, they're not as effective as picking up those small leaks. And that's what they've shown, that they struggle to find those small leaks. Even with your acoustic equipment, it's very, very hard to hear a small leak on a pipe. And that's where these dogs are picking it up. The sewer a little bit different. So mine, there's contractors, there's devices out there picking up leaks. There's now drones looking for water leaks. These are all the things that are sort of happening in that background for water leaks within Sydney Water. So we look at it in that factor going, okay, that's what their strengths are. This is what my strengths are. I'm finding this amount of leaks, which is really efficient compared to those other devices. But when you look at the devices and what they're finding, it's a very different type of leak to what I regularly find. I do find those leaks as well. I've been out over those devices and we do find those leaks as well, but we also find the smaller leaks. And we have had other circumstances where, I don't know, Bettina might and Kylie might want to talk about this scenario where they did smoke testing and then we ran the dogs. Pass it to Bettina. She can explain that one. It might be a good comparison.
Good comparison. Yeah. So sometimes they'll do smoke testing. So they blow smoke, see if it comes out, and you just see it steam up through the ground.
Okay.
And we did a job where we ran the dogs in Cogra Bay and they located 11 points and then they did smoke testing and we took GPS locations and the green dots were the dogs, the red dots were the smoke testing and you overlaid it.
Yeah.
And it was the same.
Yeah, nice.
Oh.
But the dogs were two people, two dogs. The smoke testing was a team of three guys. Like this is kind of where
this is economics.
But in saying that, it's always good to have another thing to validate.
Sure.
Right? And it's also good because the dogs can locate a point, but they don't have tool belts. They're not going to fix the leaks for us. So
validation's the name in detection work, isn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So, and it's interesting because you can measure, like, what do you measure as a dog win? Kylie and I discuss this all the time because the wastewater dogs, it is hard to measure the dog wins. And, Nicole, what's your K amount and how many leaks have you found to date?
Oh, I'm up to 492 kilometres I've covered with my dogs.
Okay.
Now that, I should explain, is what the main is.
Okay.
I put the GPS on the dog. What the dog is actually covering is three times the amount of that. What I actually cover is twice the amount of that. So we just count the main we've walked over. So 490 kilometres of main. You can work out the math of actually how much we're doing compared to that. And we're just – I'm just a fraction of 300 leaks.
Wow.
I think I'm 293.
So in comparison for US listeners, you could have walked from Melbourne to Sydney on what you've walked.
That is true.
Yep.
Yeah.
And your dog did it three times.
And I'm feeling every kilometre of it. Yeah. And you've got to think, that is not just flat road either.
No.
Like flat to Sydney to Melbourne is like a straight road, straight ahead on a this is going through some pretty heavy terrain and dealing with a very excited dog that loves its job. So you're constantly the shoulders.
Which is back to the dog selection. You guys need that lighter dog that can work big distances and it doesn't break them down, or that bigger dog is not going to be as efficient in a way because they're bigger, they're heavier. You know, if the body's going to break down, you're putting harnesses, GPSs, things on their dogs that are all things that add weight. We had a saying that I'd hear to the SEAL team guys when they would make stuff or put their kits together is, you know, they're down to the grams. because grams equals kilos, kilos equal, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And they want to make sure that they're as efficient as possible with what they carry on them. Because when you're going multiple kilometers and you have this gear on you, as you guys said, when you get rucked up, you want to be as slick as possible, but still have everything you need, because you break down just like a dog would if they have to do this kind of distance and terrain. So, you know, I, this is why everybody knows I'm a spaniel lover. You know, I also love my labs, but with the spaniels, it was, this is actually one of those great jobs that highlights why they would be really good at this kind of work, just because of how they're designed and their genetics to it. So that's a big one. Now let's talk dollars, because that's what companies care about. How much, yeah. How much have you guys saved by the use of dogs in this kind of work?
I think the rough estimate, and this needs to be updated.
Sure.
Is $14 million.
Wow.
And that's and you're also talking about getting a lake before it turns into the one that costs loads of money. So there's still a lot of development that needs to happen in this space, but that is a pretty safe estimate from a while ago. But I think it's been updated since then. I'll pass this one to Kylie.
No, actually, we've still got some work to do on that. But the justification behind that, or the way that we look at it, is, and it's really hard to put a dollar value on it because of the fact that we're doing so much preventative work. Sure. So it's we look at the fact that, okay, the dog has found this leak. What could have that turned into? We've got environmental damage. We've got public health. We've got fines from the EPA, legal costs, court costs, cleanup costs. So when we put all those things together, that's how we're coming up with figure or dollars saved. Again, it is really hard because how long would that leak gone on for?
Yeah.
If the dogs didn't find it? How big would it have become if the dogs didn't find it? And we can't say what it would have become or how long it would have gone on for. So it is quite hard.
There's some what ifs we have to consider.
Yeah. And we, you know, the dogs do an amazing job. But it's very hard to quantify exactly how much they're saving. And we don't want to be those people that go over the top and go, oh, sure, we're saving this amount of money. It's a really hard thing to quantify.
Sure.
But the dogs are doing an amazing job. And yes, they are saving Sydney Water a lot of money when it comes to those factors.
And that is an answer that most things are looking for, is how can I be efficient and save money and utilizing dogs? And this type of work clearly shows there is a cost benefit analysis, and you guys meet that need of saving money, not only saving money, but the more important bigger picture, helping the environment. And that's huge.
And I think another thing to add, we find a really, there are multiple tools. Like, so the dogs, yes, they find leaks. Yes, they save money. But another impact they've had is on the public. So they attract a lot of attention with the public, and they're like, oh, what's the dogs doing? Usually it's, is that a drug dog?
Yeah.
And we're like, no, we work for Sydney Water. We're doing water conservation work and finding water leaks, and we're doing environmental protection with the wastewater dogs, and having that public perception, them then going, oh, they're actually doing something, has got a dollar value to it as well. And we have been out to schools and spoke to the kids about careers in water that don't think like this is the only career in this box, and that's just the water industry. That's a pretty boring job, where there's so many things that probably never have been thought of.
Sure.
Or yet. And getting these kids to think about, this is what impact I can have, or maybe I want to be a dog handler in the water industry when I get older. I did have a year four student ask me when I was going to retire, which I felt like he was like taking an aim at my age. Like, they come up to me like, oh, when are you going to retire? And I'm like, oh, how old do you think I am?
You probably want your job.
Yeah. but you don't realise the impact you have on these kids, and they're really struggling to get kids in these like year five and six to follow a career in STEM, which is in science. And this, if this sort of inspires them to move forward just by showing the dogs and showing that the innovation step that Sydney Water took and went out of the box and went, oh, we normally use an engineering solution, where this is not an engineering solution, this is a science innovation. and making the kids think about it, it has an impact as well and a value to If we can change a kid's mindset on a career, it's really important.
And for sure.
We have the same view as well, seeing those, like being a female in high vis, going out in a school, going something that's a really like, and saying that we have the best job in the world. And we always say that we think we have the best job in the world. That has that money value as well.
Of course.
And I think a lot of water industries see that and they say, okay, these dogs are effective at doing this job, but there's also these other things that stem off that, which I think is really important as well. And getting that conservation message across, like we are doing, we are about to head into a drought. There's all this scientific studies to show we are heading into a drought and we're already seeing that less rainfall.
Mm.
And the importance of us finding water leaks and preventing environmental, impacts through the wastewater as well. Like we've got to save every drop. And if we can get that message across with the dogs,
they're very lucky to have the three of you, that you're that passionate and you feel that way about your job and role. I mean, that's incredible. So well done. That's, that's awesome.
So I'll recap just for the listeners. So, and you guys can tell me if I go astray at any point. So when preferred, you start off with a pup. It's going to be typically, obviously, in your guys' case, spaniel breed. But in general, a smaller breed, very well-driven, focused, and likes to range out is good qualities. Training time is about 10 months as an average. Training aids are going to be – the cool thing is you guys can get water very easily. You just get your wastewater you have for the wastewater dogs. You have your normal drinking water for the water leak detection dogs. And then your controls or your proofing materials are just a lot of the things that are in the waters. So you don't need any special chemicals. You don't need any pseudos or soaks or other things. You can just work with things that are very easy to get your hands on. Then – You guys are adapting your training to be working within the environment that you're actually going to deploy in. But you do spend some time in what we call that the laboratory, the setup, teaching in a lineup or control, correct? So then you go operationally and you start off smaller. The area isn't too big and you have your objects, your pipes, your things that you work with. And then you go operational, but you're within this time frame, you're doing plenty of double blinds as handlers. And then as operational, you get a call, a need, and then you have to plan, and then you deploy, you collect data, test it, and then submit reports. So start to finish, does that kind of cover a lot of what you guys do?
Yeah, pretty much. Good summary.
Which is because, you know,
you can do our promo if you want.
You can add a lot of admin to that.
Oh, I'm sure there's a ton of admin. And I forgot. The physicality aspect for you guys, not only all the kilometers that you walk, but the types of terrain, hills, rain conditions, freezing conditions, all kinds of or extreme heat conditions too. All of these things you guys face along with your dog. So this isn't, you know, a physical, easy type of work. This is, you need to have good joints. You need to be in shape enough to go do this. These are things that must be considered from the handler point of view. And I would say, too, on the handler side, somebody who can think critically, have a engineering kind of mindset, looking at things and how to evaluate and kind of peeling back the onion kind of thing versus a mindset that's extremely black and white. There's some gray here because we don't know things all the time and information could be wrong initially and teams have already maybe disrupted an area and then you have to go in and go do the work. So, yeah. Anything you guys want to add?
I think what I look for and what I think is really important as a handler is number one, patience. Number two is how you deal with things when things don't go to plan.
Yeah.
Because if you can't deal with like situations when the dog comes out and it's not performing to what it normally does and step back and think about, okay, what do I need to do this at this moment to either get this dog to work or I just can it and go, no, it's not going to work today. Having that mindset of how to deal with that, it's a really hard trait to find because people can't a lot of people won't admit when they go, oh, that didn't work or I failed about doing it. Like they'll go straight into failure instead of going, okay, what can I learn from this?
Sure.
And a lot of people struggle with that, and you'll see it, and then it goes down the lead, and they start to get upset, and then of course the dog's then going to get even worse. Yeah. And that's what I think is probably the number
big
one
qualities
and,
for
yeah
handler.
And yeah. Being able to look at your dog and really know the movements and really know the body language and being able to have that enthusiasm, like that passion, like the passion has to be there.
Oh, for sure.
You get someone that just goes, oh, I'm going to hold the lead and I'm going to walk it along, yeah, and then the dog's going to find things. You're not going to get the best out of the dog, and you're not going to enjoy it. Like, I love watching the dog and love watching its move, and knowing that my hand has to be here and that little head movement, I need to bring the dog back around, and that's what makes my day interesting.
Yeah.
And,
no,
when,
it's super
and then
cool.
You get to play with the ball.
Yeah.
So all our dogs are on ball and they love the ball, and I look like an idiot on the side of the road, and you've got to have that idiotness, like that idiotic behavior too.
Yeah, I think
as well.
A sense of humor, I think, is quite,
yeah,
quite,
yeah,
critical.
Yeah.
I think being creative, a sense of humor, and yes, I think the patience one is a good one.
Yep.
And being silly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you have to be quite silly. Like when a dog does a good job, you know, you bridge it, you reward.
Yep.
Oh, over the,
yeah,
top. Oh, what a good dog.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because you want the dog to love the work, and you want to love the work too, because often, yeah, you can have a bit of a bad day.
Yeah.
But if you can still have fun with your dog, I think so.
Yeah.
Have fun with your dog and the dog loving it.
Critical thinking too. A science head helps. Yeah.
Yes.
My favorite saying, every day at work has got to be a day in the park.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
There you go.
Every day needs to be a day in the park for my dog.
Yeah.
That's all sage advice. I like all that.
Yeah.
I got nothing to add to that. I think that's great.
Thank you guys so much for taking your time to explain what a wonderful type of detection field this is. Obviously, you're at the tip of this. This is, like I said, we've seen it in other places around the world, but this is still an extremely new career field. And obviously, I have a feeling a very expanding one soon. You don't have to say it here, but if you guys are willing to, because this episode is going to draw questions and attention. So are you guys first willing to take emails and answer questions?
Absolutely.
That you're
going to, okay. Yeah, sure.
So what I'll do is I'll get your guys' emails and I'll put that in the show notes, and then that way they can get it that way, that we don't have to try to say your whole thing on the air here. But I will put it in the show notes. So those that are listening and watching this, if you want more information, that'll be in the show notes. Contact these guys and they will give you their experiences and, you know, the pros and cons, and kind of like we did in this episode. Again, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been really great. Our first podcast experience. It's been great.
Awesome. Good. We were glad to do it.
As a team.
Yes.
Well, thanks Sydney Water for agreeing to it.
And normally you have Pat at this point, but remember, like, share, subscribe.
Oh, yeah, we can. I can do all the laid out.
I had to at least try it for you. But thank you guys very much.